IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of All Things Policy. The Communist Party of China last week held the fifth plenary session of the 19th Communist Party Central Committee. Presided over by Secretary Xi Jinping, the primary task was to assess the result of 13th five-year plan and draft proposal for the 14th five-year plan. The meeting also provided insight into Chinese domestic politics. As usual, the plenum was hosted at a closely guarded hotel in Western Beijing with no access to independent media or observers or analysts. So there is a lot of speculation about what has happened into the plenum. To discuss more about this, we have with us the China dude, Manoj Kevalramani. Hi, Manoj.
Hi, Sush.
Manoj, before we deep dive into what has happened and what were the basic or major takeaways from the plenum, can you first explain to us what a plenary session means?
So a plenary session, I mean, it's not a specific word to China. A plenary session is essentially a session of part of a conference or a meeting. It's one specific session within that. In the sort of Chinese Communist Party, in the sort of Communist Party system, what happens is that you every 5 years you have a new central committee elected. So we are currently in the 19th central committee, which came into place in October 2017, and then every time the central committee meets, you end up, that's called a plenary session of the central committee. Usually these, there's no sort of fixed timetable per se that each of these sessions has to happen on a given date and time, but usually they happen in sort of the fall, they happen in October or November. But like I said, there's no specific timetable. They can be called even sort of off the sort of normal routine. I mean, an example was, this was just a couple of years ago, right? In 2017, October, when the 19th Party Congress happened and you had the Central Committee come into play. Few months after that, you had the second plenary session of the 19th Central Committee in January for 2 days, during which, you know, and this came out of the blue. You had the sudden session and you had an announcement about some reforms and amendments to the Constitution of China. Everybody understood that that was about taking away presidential term limits along with some other changes. Then you had, you know, a month later, in end of February, from 26th to 28th February, you had another plenary session, which is the third plenary session. These sessions usually don't happen at this close proximity, but that was the session where you sort of finalized the list of people who would sort of, nominees who would sort of be part of this thing. And it also sort of confirmed the direction that, yes, the Constitution was going to be amended. And then the fourth plenary session, you know, so the third one takes place in February 2018. The fourth one takes place in October 2019. So that 2018 fall, you don't have a plenary session. But in 2019 October, you have the fourth plenary session, at which there was a decision on how do you improve the system of governance that the Chinese Communist Party has set up. How do you make it much more stronger and all of that. And now you've had the fifth plenary session, which has dealt with largely economic issues, like you said. And the objective is that the 13th five-year plan, which was set up in 2016, is culminating in 2020. And you need to have a new five-year plan, which is part of the planned economy system. And what is, in terms of that, constructing that plan and putting in details in that plan, this plenary session sort of engaged in putting together details of what would go in that. And that's what the conversation was largely about. And it obviously, like you said, gives us hints about what is happening within the domestic political system also.
Yeah, that very well, your last point very well gives me a cue to the next question. So what were the important, why this plenum was important, as you have already highlighted, due to the transition from 13 to 14 five-year plan. So what was CCP's observation or assessment regarding the 13th five-year plan? And what are the important goals for set in the 14th one? Could you highlight them, please, Manoj?
Yeah, so the first thing is that, look, the 14th five-year plan is not yet made. So we don't have the plan detail public. And from what I understand, even the plan has not been fully put together. Also, when it comes to these plans, usually each five-year plan comes with like a tremendous number of other plans associated with it. So there'll be lots of documents that I presume we'll start to get access to early next year. Because right now the drafting process is currently underway. So that's point one. In terms of the 13th five-year plan, it wouldn't be surprising to anybody that what there was a lot of patting yourself on the back. The 13th five-year plan, throughout the sort of last couple of months, you had the Chinese media essentially talking about how those goals of the 13th five-year plan have been met. And the broad goal was obviously, this idea of achieving a quote-unquote moderately prosperous society by 2020, which the argument is that has been achieved. The key indicator for that is the idea that absolute poverty has been eliminated. And you will see going forward also as this year ends, there's going to be a lot of conversation about the elimination of absolute poverty. And I presume next year in March, when the National People's Congress, which is a legislative meeting, happens, you will have an acknowledgement of the fact that this is a goal that has been finally achieved. In terms of the elimination of poverty has been achieved. The other idea is that how do you see what is a moderately prosperous society? Well, the idea is that, you've doubled your GDP from, over the last 10 years, which has taken place. And obviously the 2020 annual GDP is yet to come. But, these figures are always malleable. So I presume the doubling will easily happen. These are political goals and figures are always malleable. So you will end up getting that place also, get to that place also. The fact that China's GDP is sort of around $14 trillion, which is, significant. The growth is significant. It's sort of about 2/3 of the US economy in nominal terms. So in that sense, that goal has been achieved. So those are your goals that you will see. The other thing also that was said was about technological innovation, which increasingly has become all the more important. It's not like it wasn't in the past. You had the last medium and long-term plan on technological innovation in 2006. It was a 15-year document, which led you till 2020. And based on that, then you had so many other technology plans, plans on robotics, plans on AI, and so on and so forth, which all sort of gave you targets in and around this period and going forward also. So what we understand is there's a new national medium long-term plan for technology development that's currently under work. Again, this is one of the many plans that will come out over the next couple of months in the first half of the next year going forward. So I think that's the other thing that you need to keep in mind, that you're going to have a lot of these plans. In terms of the economic issues, what we saw was that they issued a communique after the session ended. The communique is fairly vague in many ways. It doesn't necessarily give you clear indications of, these were the targets or this is what's been agreed upon. Some of the important highlights are that they talked about goals till 2035, a long-term view, which is again something that's not been done for a long time. You talked about having a long-term view of, modernization till 2035. You talked about the five-year plan, which ends at 2025. You also talked about no clear defined GDP targets. Like I said, 10, 11 years ago, there was a talk of doubling the GDP by 2020. Right now, you're not really talking about that. And that's been a systematic process of de-emphasizing GDP targets over the last couple of years, where every year you wouldn't necessarily announce that this is where we want to go, this is where we want to reach. Because that puts pressure on local government officials who then chase GDP as opposed to other goals. And Xi Jinping's sort of agenda after the 19th Party Congress was to revamp that incentive that you don't necessarily just chase GDP growth, but you chase what he called high quality growth, which includes environment and other things also. So again, so sticking to that, you saw that there was no announcement of a GDP target for the next 10, 15 years or whatever. But there was lots of talk about focusing on technological innovation and how that is more important. There was talk about focusing on dual circulation, which is this new buzzword, but which essentially means that you want to emphasize domestic consumption as part of your economic drivers, more so than relying on, say, export-led growth. So you want to not necessarily de-emphasize exports, but your growth strategy must change, shift towards domestic consumption. Again, this is a long-term process. They've been talking about this for a very long time. COVID has made it even more difficult to do this, but also COVID has really, the pandemic has led to this sort of change in the global system that, you know, Beijing feels that it needs to focus more on its domestic market because the international market might become far more difficult for it. So these are some of the sort of broad economic indicators, focus on technology, no specific target for GDP, a sense of achievement in terms of overall GDP growth over the last 10 years, poverty alleviation, technological advancement and so on. Yet these challenges that need to be met going down to 2035. The last point that I want to re-emphasize is, again, the talk of a long-term vision again to 2035. So that's the other thing that Xi Jinping is setting the agenda going forward.
Manoj, if I remember correctly, the communique also mentioned a bit about the CCP's worldview of assessment of security situation around China. So could you emphasize a bit on that? So how does CCP view world around itself and intensifying disputes with the United States? How does the party views that right now?
Yeah, I think if you go back, if you've observed what's happened over the last couple of years between the US and China, and particularly this year with the sort of heightened tensions around the pandemic, what you would have heard is that, increasingly, for the last couple of years, you would have heard probably more so Chinese sort of propaganda talking about unprecedented changes in the world, global balance of power shifting and those sorts of things, right? I mean, you've read the defense white papers. They also talk about shifting global balance of power and so on and so forth. This communique uses a phrase which talks about, the profound shift in profound adjustment in the international balance of power. Again, the first time that you're moving from unprecedented to profound and adjustment of balance of power, it's not a new phrase, but it's the first time that it's been used in such a document. It tells you a little bit about how China views the world outside right now going through serious churn. It views this predominantly not just in the context of its relationship with the US becoming far more difficult and security sort of stresses intensifying, whether it's in the maritime domain or in the land or around the land boundary, but also in terms of sort of changes to the economic balance of power. China sees itself playing a bigger role in the world, but it also sees increasing challenges when it comes to, say, talk about supply chain resilience in other parts of the world. Countries wanting to sort of adapt to, if not decoupling, but at least a China plus one strategy, wherein you're saying that we might have a supply chain structure for China, but something more also has to happen because you can't be entirely dependent on one economy. And this is something that we've seen throughout this pandemic, right? The fact that the Chinese economy produced such a significant chunk of all the healthcare supplies that went around the world, sanitizers, masks, PPE kits and so on and so forth. And the questions that we saw in March, April, May about the quality of those supplies, the use of this healthcare support and aid and sales that were provided for political purposes. And that led to sort of backlash. The fact that, when initially China shut down, there was concern that, industries are struggling because China is a key cog in the supply chain. And if that shuts down, then you don't know where to go. Your goods are stuck. So that started this desire for resilience in supply chains. But then subsequently, the sense that China was leveraging the pandemic for political and economic ends, sort of exploitative ends, led to more calls for, shifting supply chains. Now, these are long-term processes. And I think Beijing is understanding that the world is changing. And this sort of recognizes that change in the world. At the same time, I don't think it's looking at the world and saying that it's fundamentally threatening. The communique still talks about China being in a period of strategic opportunity. A phrase that's been long used in the past also. But the fact that they are still saying this, sort of acknowledges in some ways that there are still opportunities there. To me, those opportunities arise from the fact that, say Europe in the last 6 to 8 months, despite the friction between the US and China, you've seen Europe try to push forward to negotiate an investment agreement with China. As conscious Western European powers have become about Chinese influence and the challenges of overdependence on Beijing, they've also not necessarily gone ahead to decouple in some significant way. They've also looked at deepening economic ties. They've also looked at doing things like you know, not necessarily overtly taking any punitive steps with regard to human rights issues on China. The narrative has shifted, but it's not shifted in terms of policy action. And I think Beijing Bank is still banking on the fact that, you know, you can have enough economic incentives to make sure that that doesn't happen. And then you won't end up seeing something like a transatlantic unity or things like that. Yet it's also wary of the fact that, you know, this whole business of the Indo-Pacific and all is something that is challenging. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, you had Wang Yi going to, I can't remember, Indonesia, where he spoke about the fact that this idea of the Indo-Pacific is an attempt to create an, or the Quad is the attempt to create an Asian NATO. So there is a threat perception that they feel, which is where this business of profound adjustment comes. Profound adjustment also comes in the fact that its own rise and its own increasing global clout, and that it feels that it plays a much bigger role and can and should play a much bigger role. But also that there are these opportunities at multiple levels, that it still remains a central player in the broader global economy. So it has still a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, Manoj, there were two important visions on which Western and Indian scholars particularly gave a lot of emphasis on. The first one was the social modernization goal by 2035. And the second one was the PLA modernization goal by 2027. The latter being something new because this was not being set in the 2017 Party Congress. Generally, the goals that we identified were 2020, 2035 and 2049 for PLA. So what insights do you have on this, especially the latter one, when they said that 2027 is something where PLA is supposed to modernize?
So on the first thing, let's just look at it this way, right? China is saying that it wants to achieve socialist modernization by 2035. Like you said, it's not necessarily a new statement, but what does socialist modernization mean? It's really, really difficult to figure out what they mean by it because there's no real tangible goal. But if the idea is that, you know, your GDP is going to achieve a level of, you know, sort of moderately developed countries, let's put it that way. So something like a South Korea, you know, is where your GDP needs to achieve, hit, or some countries in Europe where your GDP needs to hit that level. And I'm saying per capita GDP, not on the whole. Then you need to hit about, say, 30, 35, 40,000 US dollars per capita in terms of your GDP. China currently is at around $10,000 per capita. So that's an incredibly ambitious goal, right? In 15 years to, you know, more than double, nearly triple your per capita GDP. And that's a significant. So if that's what they mean, then that'll be interesting to see where they get to on that. And again, these are targets. There is no inevitability to China's continuous growth. These are good targets. It tells us a little bit about where Beijing wants to head or what it sees as reasonable and achievable over a period of time. Yet, it's going to be challenging to get there because any to get to that point of such high levels of GDP will require fundamental adjustments in structures of labor and capital. Will we see reform of the hukou system, which will allow better migration, which will allow assimilation of people in the formal economy? And if you do see that, will you see how will that impact the sort of social political power dynamics within China? Because it's not, you know, the fact that as groups get empowered through engagement in the formal economy, they become important actors also. So I think it's also critical that it will change the balance in the country, social political balance in the country. So I think to be able to take those decisions and to be able to get there is going to be challenging. It's not going to be as straightforward. But this is the ambition that they've outlined. And also, as you reach that figure, how does society evolve, whether the system sustains and so on and so forth is also something that we need to see. So as an economic goal, it's fine, but economic changes also have social political changes. So that's something that we'll have to see over a period of time. On the issue of the PLA. So, I mean, we read the 2019 defense white paper. It didn't talk about any such goal about 2027. So this is an interesting goal. I think what it's telling us is that it tells us a little bit firstly about the fact that Beijing's threat perception with regard to changes in the international order and its security interests is heightened. So you're going to see greater money being thrown at the PLA. So you're probably going to be seeing much more expenditure on defense equipment, research, and so on and so forth, training and the rest of it. The other thing is that, you know, it's talking about a modern military, you know, by 2027, what does that mean? Does it mean capabilities to operate globally, with X number of aircraft carriers or bases around the world? We'll have to see whether that's something that is going to. But if that's what it means, then you're going to see far more militarization of the BRI. That's the sort of global part of it. So I'd say what you will see is that you will see lots more investment going into the PLA if that's what they want to do. You'll see much, much more development in terms of equipment. You'll also see maybe far more aggressive negotiations internationally to militarize the BLA, militarize the BRI. So you might see a base or two at least, because if you want to achieve a modern military, the objective of the modern military is to compete with the US armed forces, then you will need bases around the world. So that will then have sort of some sort of a ripple effect on China's security, because let's assume that the first bases are somewhere in, say, Cambodia, Pakistan. That will have a ripple effect in terms of reactions by other powers. So that then may constrain Beijing's activities. So I think we have to wait to see what they mean by that, because they don't define these goals very, very clearly. Predominantly, the objective will be the Western Pacific, which has been the objective. So if they mean that modern military means maintaining Chinese hegemony, clear Chinese hegemony, and PLA's control over its sort of near seas and sort of controlling that area, that's one thing. But if it means competing with the US globally, then you'll have to see tremendous amount of monies being spent and tremendous amount of diplomatic activity to be able to create that position where you can compete with the US globally. I don't think they're anywhere close to that right now. 2027 is 7 years away. I mean, after this year, I think it's very difficult for anybody to predict where the world goes. But my sense is that it's still to be able to get the kind of basing, to be able to get the kind of systems, to be able to get the kind of experience, it's a short period of time. But then again, it depends on how the US plays, and how the rest of the world responds to all of this. The last thing is that the fact that you have a 2027 goal, it tells you a little bit about Xi Jinping's desire to stay in power at least until then. Because 2022 will be the 20th Party Congress and 2027 will be the 21st Party Congress. Mm. Xi Jinping should be in his late 70s at that point of time. So my sense is that, he wants to stick around for that moment. It's also the 100th anniversary of the PLA. So, I think he wants to stick around to that point of time. And that's what it's also telling us.
Thank you so much, Manoj. It was a fascinating conversation. For more such China analysis, you can subscribe to two newsletters which we write. One, the first one by Manoj himself, it's called Eye on China. It covers China's internal politics, China's activities in South Asia and the US-China relations, and also India-China relations. The second one is it's written by me. It's called the PLA Insight. It gives insight into PLA's activity in East Asia and South Asia. Thank you guys. Thank you for listening.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.